ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If this thing is built, it will be a miracle to behold.
One of science's biggest promises.
It would be like the Wright brothers moment.
Governments, spies, billion-dollar investments, and scientific rivalries.
The control that's required is rivaled only by what God did in creating the universe.
Will quantum computers change everything? I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there, Laura Tingle. You do a bit of world travel. What's your favourite capital city?
A predictable choice, Hamish, but Paris.
So ABC.
I know.
So what about some of the purpose-built capital cities? Brasilia, Washington.
Canberra.
Obviously. On this episode, we're putting a brand new, not quite finished capital on the radar.
I'm Laura Tingle.
I'm Hamish McDonald. Let's go roaming. Well, we're starting the week with our On The Radar episode and a very warm welcome back to Laura Tingle. Great to see you, Laura. We're going to stop off in the new Indonesian capital, which may or may not actually happen, and there is quite a bit of politics at the heart of this story. Amanda Hodge from the Australian newspaper has just been in Nusantara, the new capital planned for Indonesia. She has always been a real sceptic of it, so I'm kind of curious to see where she's landed at the moment.
I mean, despite offering a blueprint for a new way of living as a modern Asian city, the Indonesian president is putting the brakes on it and investors are being scared off.
And another story that we're going to dip into on this episode is one that's really been flying under the radar a bit, I reckon, and that's the rise of Pakistan as a global good citizen, a diplomatic powerhouse, if you want to describe it that way. They've obviously been playing a big part in the discussions between Iran and the US, so they've been in the headlines a lot. But we're going to explore the politics and the motivations behind this new good cop role that they seem to be playing. Amanda Hodge, welcome back to Global Roaming. Shall we roam?
Thanks, Hamish. Good to be here.
Take us to Nusantara. Where exactly is it? What's the status of this particular capital in the making?
Nusantara is in East Kalimantan, which is part of the Indonesian section of Borneo Island. So it's a long way from Jakarta. It's about 2 hours drive from the closest city, which is Balikpapan, which is kind of the heart of extractive industries for Indonesia, sort of oil and gas, coal, part of Indonesia. Yeah, out of the jungles of Borneo, they have begun, or at least are a fair way into building a new city now.
How ambitious is it, Amanda? I mean, what's it sort of supposed to look like? How many people are supposed to live there? What do Indonesians think about it?
Yeah. It's capped at under 2 million people, and I think the expectation is that about 1.5 million of those people will be civil servants, bureaucrats, you know, politicians eventually. It is, I have to say, a remarkable achievement so far. I think it's an extraordinary place. It is extremely ambitious. There's no doubt about that. And it just does things no other Indonesian city does right now. And, you know, of course you would expect that because you can build it from the ground up. Jakarta is celebrating its 499th anniversary this month, you know, with all the attending problems of a 500-year-old capital, whereas, you know, they have this opportunity to do things differently, show Indonesians, you know, a different way to live. And also, I think, as importantly, you know, show a new face to the world, because Indonesia has massive ambitions. You know, it wants to be a high-income nation by 2045. It wants to be consequential, you know, in global kind of affairs. You know, with its population, with its sort of economy, that's not an unreasonable ambition. But people have views, perspectives about Indonesia that it's quite desperate to change. And I think, you know, if Nusantara does come off, if they are able to pull it off and it does become the new capital, then it genuinely is a new modern face for Indonesia. And that's not such a terrible thing.
Hang on. Amanda Hodge, I've been reading your work for years. You have got to be one of the biggest skeptics of this new capital that writes in the Australian Press. So what on earth has gone on? Have you been captured or something?
I may not have been the biggest skeptic of everyone. I mean, I did understand that there were good sort of theoretical reasons behind this, which is Indonesia has been, you know, for centuries, really Java-centric, right? You know, 50% of the population lives on Java Island. More than 50% of the economy is based around Java Island. But, you know, what about the rest of the country? You know, there's 17,000 islands in Indonesia. And a lot of, you know, a lot of Indonesians feel a bit sort of marginalized by that. So I always understood that argument. It's just that, you know, up until this week, all I really knew about Indonesia was that big presidential palace with the hulking, not particularly lovely Garuda sort of monstering the top of it. Everyone's seen that image. But then you drive into this city, you know, it's there's very thoughtful, you know, intentional kind of street art. There's obviously every, you know, the usual crisscrossing, scary live electric wires of, you know, Jakarta and other cities that are nowhere to be seen. The architecture is really quite stunning. This capital is ringed by mountains. It's in a beautiful spot. It's doing things that no other city can do. So, you know, it's trying to focus on outdoor living. I mean, if anyone has spent any time in Indonesia, you know, that's hard to do because it's so hot and the footpaths and the roads don't work. And that's not the case here. You can drink from the tap in every, you know, apartment, which is to me, after 9 years in Indonesia and 7 years in India, just the most extraordinary thing, you know.
How are we living outdoors in this new possible capital, Amanda? Like, what's going on?
25% of the inner core of Nusantara is built space and the rest of it is green space. So there's proper walkways. I don't know if you've ever been to Singapore and, you know, the most socially engineered, I think, city on the planet where you can walk through Henderson Waves and all those other amazing aerial walkways. And it's not dissimilar to that in the sense that, you know, the center of it is all about walking and water bodies that can help pick up the breeze and sort of cool down the area. Of course, it's hot in the middle of the day. And part of the reason for that is there's no smog to, you know, shelter you from the sun like in Jakarta where you don't get sunburned because the poor old sun can't fight its way through those layers of pollution.
Who said smog was all bad? Well, so what's happening, Amanda? It sounds like there's been an extraordinary amount already achieved to build the city, but it's being sidelined by the current president. Is that right?
Yeah, I think you could reasonably say it's been sidelined. Look, there was about $6 billion worth of construction under the former president, Joko Widodo. And they were in a mad hurry, you know, because he knew that he was on his second and constitutionally last presidential term. He really wanted to get it past the point of no return, which he did. But the moment Prabowo came into office, you rarely ever heard about Nusantara. You just don't hear him speak about it. Last year's budget was barely $500 million, which sounds like, I'm talking Australian dollars, which sounds a lot, but not at all compared to, you know, the sort of feverish pace of construction before then, and certainly not when you compare it to the bungled free meals program we hear a lot about, that is Prabowo's priority program, which this year is budgeted at $21.6 billion. They've spent $6 billion and they've got the one and a half kind of stages of a new city built. When you compare that to, you know, this the poor old free meals program. Yeah, he's not interested. It's someone else's legacy.
But just on that, hasn't it been signed as a presidential declaration that it would be the political capital by 2028? Isn't that going to happen? And in any event, isn't Jakarta sinking? So isn't the environment going to force their hand to some extent? Yeah,
it's not been signed yet. And it's up to Prabowo to sign it. And just recently, the Constitutional Court here reaffirmed that Jakarta is the capital until Prabowo Subianto signs the decree that moves the capital officially to Nusantara. That's supposed to happen in 2028. So this is a looming political problem for Prabowo Subianto because he's clearly not interested in this capital. I'm sure he doesn't actually want to live there himself. you know, he has a beautiful ranch above Jakarta. You know, he's essentially a city guy, right? He's a kind of, he loves going to France and, you know, Paris and...
You should tell him about Laura Tingle. Paris is her favourite capital.
So, but have parts of the bureaucracy already moved there, Amanda? I mean, is it functioning at all in that new capital role?
Look, most of the people who live there are part of the OIKN, which is the authority that runs Nusantara. Mm. There are about 500 extra civil servants, mostly central bank people that are rotated in and out, and health ministry. There will be more. There's about 1,000 families and students arriving next month, which will be great because the demographic is essentially right now 20-somethings. They're the ones who are willing to come and, you know, get free accommodation, salary bonuses, free Wi-Fi, free bills, etc. You know, but what it needs is demographic kind of diversity, and that's starting. But, you know, it's this chicken and egg argument. The state has done a lot there now, and right now the parliament and the court complexes are being built and they're mooted to be finished in 2028. So there is a reasonable argument for Poboa saying, I can't sign this into law until we've got an actual parliament to sit in, until we've got courts where we can put the judges. So that's fair enough. But in the meantime, you'll never hear the end of civil servants here in Jakarta talking about how long it takes to get from their satellite cities into the city to work, right? There's no reason why the government couldn't accelerate the rate at which they are moving willing first movers from Jakarta and elsewhere to Nusantara. But their targets for that are so anemic. They want to get 4,000 civil servants into the capital by 2028. But the private investors are currently saying, well, it's a suicide mission going in there when there's 10,000 people sleeping in Nusantara at night. We need more than that. We need a critical mass to justify our investment. And, you know, it's hard to fault that argument.
You're listening to Global Roaming from ABC's Radio National. It's Hamish here with Laura Tingle. On this episode, Amanda Hodge is taking us roaming. She's the Asia Pacific correspondent for the Australian newspaper. She's been working throughout the region for many years. Let's talk about another capital that was constructed, purpose-built, and that's Islamabad, which is really taking a slightly different seat at the global table at the moment, isn't it?
Dear old Islamabad, I've spent a long time in that capital, and there's a lot to love about that place too. I see these two stories as kind of similar in the sense they're about countries trying to redefine their place and external perceptions of them, right? And Pakistan rightly took a big hit after the bin Laden raid, and I think that was in May 2011, where they discovered, you know, the world's most wanted terrorist hiding out a couple of kilometres from the country's most important military training academy. It wasn't the beginning of the end. I think it was the middle of the end for the long US-Pakistan alliance, which sort of has its roots in the Cold War era. But, you know, the Iran-US war has brought Pakistan back in from the cold in the most kind of amazing way, right? I mean, I don't know if you heard J.D. Vance, the US vice president, talk about how the two most important people in his life now are an Indian and a Pakistani. The Indian is his wife and the Pakistani is Field Marshal Asim Munir, who was the man who essentially shuffled back and forth between, you know, Iranian and US officials trying to knit together some sort of a peace deal.
And there was a great feeling of, you know, status and credibility for Pakistan in getting this done. You know, they wanted it to be called the Islamabad Accord and all those sorts of things. Mm. But to what extent, Amanda, does it also involve a really, you know, fundamental change in the way Pakistan sees itself in this really fragmenting world order? I mean, it's fascinating to me. You've got effectively like a Sunni Shia thing happening between Pakistan and some of the Gulf states with Saudi Arabia. When I was in the Middle East over the last few months, you had this real sense of a new sense in the Gulf and in Saudi of going, hey, wait a minute, this is actually an opportunity for us to run things.
And can you just explain, Laura, because obviously you were in the Gulf a lot during all of this.
Yeah.
What's the relationship between Qatar, which had been trying to broker things, had been, in the middle of the Iranians and the Americans also obviously played a big role when it came to dealing with Gaza.
Mm.
Are they dealing with the Pakistanis? What's their view of Pakistan's role?
I think they're sort of basically getting on okay. I mean, they're coming at it from different perspectives. I think that, you know, Pakistan's got this link with Iran. Qatar's traditionally had a link with, you know, mainly sort of the Americans, and it's got links with the other states. So they've all got slightly different relationships with each other.
Yeah.
But I think the Pakistan sort of embedding in Iran is sort of much more, not tribal, but much, much closer than the Qatar one, which was always very much a pragmatic one, like most of the Gulf states have with Iran.
And Amanda, what about China? Because there is a close relationship between Pakistan and China as well. And there's been a lot of speculation that really Pakistan's role in a way was a front for China trying to ensure that this whole situation in Iran was brought to some sort of conclusion.
Oh, I don't think you can underestimate the agency of Pakistan. And Pakistan's had a long relationship with Qatar. If you remember that Qatar was the country that negotiated the end of the US-NATO forces in Afghanistan. That was in Pakistan's interest too. It had a, you know, Pakistan is the great poker player in this region, and it sees itself as what it believes it should have always been the case. As far as China goes, I think that relationship has waxed and waned a bit over the last decade or so. I don't think China has been as economically as much of a windfall as Pakistan had hoped it would be. And I think it sees it very much in its interests to broaden its kind of alliance network, to reinvigorate that US alliance that had been the bedrock really for Pakistan for many years. And given that its relationship with China hasn't been all it had hoped it would be, I think being able to straddle those worlds, the Gulf states, Iran, China and the US, is the best of all possible worlds for Pakistan. It's geographically quite strategically located. It, you know, it is a country that has been able to demonstrate over many years its ability to handle or withstand crisis. And that might not be, you know, it might not come out smelling like roses, or it might not benefit, but it withstands. It always, you know, Pakistan's always there.
It's also a nuclear country, is very interesting for countries in the Gulf and Saudi, which are now sort of looking and going, oh, what's going on here? We're a bit nervous. We now see Israel as the great threat to the place. It provides that sort of, you know, potential relationship with a nuclear armed power as well.
That's right. And it did strike a really interesting defence agreement with Saudi last year, which I think speaks to that.
I suppose as this conversation's unfolding, I'm thinking though back to the 9/11 era when it was Pervez Musharraf in power, right? And a very strong ally to George Bush during that time. I mean, it's not necessarily altogether new that Pakistan's trying to assert itself on the global stage. Is the difference that we're observing here more this role of an interlocutor? Is that what we're talking about, Amanda?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an interesting role for Pakistan because it's always, you know, seen itself as the chess master moving the pieces behind the scenes. And this was a different role for it. But the key for Pakistan is how it is able to convert this sort of international kudos it's now enjoying into economic benefit, because it is an economic basket case and has been for years, for decades, in fact. And it was the US that was sort of helping to prop it up. And the fact that it was the key supply route, you know, into Afghanistan for all those years that, you know, the US and NATO were there, that was helping to prop it up as well. And like I said, China hasn't been the big windfall it had hoped it would be. And the question now is, you know, what it does with this kudos.
Wouldn't it be a smart thing to do for the Pakistani economy to have a more manageable relationship with India? Aren't they going for something like 8% growth?
It would be the smart thing to do, but they just, you know, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I crossed the, you know, the Wagah border between India and Pakistan on foot, and just the curiosity on either sides of the border about their, you know, their brothers on the other side, because that's essentially what they are. You know, it's such an unnatural cleave of land that, you know, has for millennia been united. And so it's, you know, we don't need to go into the history of partition and how it split families and split land. But those scars are still very, very deep. And I think the world would love to see Pakistan and India smooth over their differences. But there's so much violence and water under the bridge there. And most recently with the Kashmir attack in Pahalgam, where 20-odd people were gunned down, and India's immediate response was to blame Pakistan. And they're probably right, you know. They sort of exist to undermine each other right now. I can't see that changing any time in the near future. And in fact, India would be seeing Pakistan's rise as a terrible thing. They would be gnashing their teeth over this.
Shall we do some feedback, Laura?
We should do some feedback, I think.
There's something from Bruce Ricketts. Would you like to share it?
I would. Thank you for your Indonesian and AUKUS series. I'm a PhD candidate at Swinburne, and my thesis is titled Indonesia-Australia Relations in the AUKUS Era, the Regional and Indonesian Perceptions of Australia, acting increasingly as a proxy for US power, have not been adequately addressed. Perhaps a dovetailing of the Indonesian and AUKUS series would be of interest to the listener, Bruce Ricketts.
Could you give us a sense, Amanda, of how AUKUS is viewed in the region in Southeast Asia? We know some of the initial responses that came through, but as the debate has unfurled, how are things looking?
Yeah, I think all the original initial angst about AUKUS has died down significantly. And at the beginning, Indonesia and Malaysia, but particularly Indonesia, was probably the most vocal. I think they felt most keenly that it was a demonstration that Australia didn't trust it. Mm. And that as the de facto power in ASEAN, it should have been brought into the confidence of these three nations as the country also that controls most of the transit routes, right? Mm. The straits that submarines would have to traverse to get anywhere. But over time, you know, Australia worked extremely hard to assuage Indonesia's concerns about that. And that was, I think, quite successful.
And do you think it's also just partly that they may share some of the scepticism about whether this will actually ever take shape the way it was originally envisaged?
I think the debate has moved on a bit. Yeah, maybe. I don't know if they think about it in those terms, but Japan and South Korea are now also looking at nuclear-powered subs, right? I don't think South Korea is probably that far away from it. Mm. And Australia might have been the first mover in this part of the world on that front, but things have accelerated to the point where, you know, I mean, if you listen to Japan during the Shangri-La dialogue, which is the primary defence dialogue for the region last month, I mean, it made no bones about the fact that it was going to step up and help supply modern military equipment and weapons to all of the Southeast Asia region. It would help coordinate security and defence plans and interoperability. And that was welcomed. If Japan had stood up and said that 5 years ago, there would have been, you know, in the very polite ASEAN way, there would have been a mass cringe.
Yes.
And a quick, you know, flurry of sort of statements designed to sort of talk that down. But everyone has had to, I think, even those who are closest to China, like, you know, the sort of client states like Laos and Cambodia even, I think everyone understands that the threat is much greater than it was, and that sitting on your hands and trying to balance the, you know, ever-waning security guarantee of the US with the trade might and accelerating muscularity of China is just not working anymore. And, you know, they have to do some things for themselves.
We've had this feedback, Amanda, from Jesse and Elia. They're writing to us while they're sailing around the Indonesian archipelago, listening to our mini-series on Indonesia. Their little sailboat is called All the Stars. They say this is our first year sailing here, although they've travelled extensively through many parts of Indo in their 20s and 30s, chasing waves and remote dive sites. The one question that crosses my mind, they write, is, as we sail around, concerns this very issue of marine resource management. With a culture that is largely fishing-based, coupled with an ever-growing population and improved fishing techniques, what will happen when the fisheries finally collapse? How will a fisherman in a remote village earn a living? What will replace this protein source for a nation of hungry mouths? The plastics waste issue is also painfully obvious, with urgent need for governments to rise to the challenge of providing better waste management and awareness. So I guess from this email from Jesse and Elia, Amanda, I'm kind of curious how you think about the spread of economic growth. Like, we can see all the reasons that it's great for people living in Java, maybe people that might move to the new capital if indeed it happens. But it is pretty patchy.
Yeah, it is. And it's the sort of eternal question for, you know, every Indonesian government that agonizes and worries about the unity of Indonesia, because it is patched together from different ancient kingdoms, and it's hard to maintain that unity, especially when, you know, those in, let's say, remote East Nusa Tenggara and all the way to sort of Rote Island to Papua and Sulawesi see the dynamism and wealth of Java, and how does that translate? And in some ways, Nusantara is designed to address this issue. It's not the full answer by any stretch to this, but what it's trying to do is, if you put the capital somewhere else, then, you know, you're diverting investment somewhere else rather than pouring everything into Java, which already has most of the wealth in Indonesia. And I spoke to a couple of people in Nusantara who were working there, and they were coming from places like Sulawesi, and they were telling me that, you know, Sulawesi, which is reasonably close to Kalimantan, is also benefiting from the rise of this capital. And, you know, they were now the preferred supplier of choice, this region, for the capital, as opposed to, you know, Surabaya or another city in Java. So that is a shift. If the capital does indeed become Nusantara, I think that will definitely help to spread wealth and investment to other parts of the region. But I don't know what the long-term solution is. And as far as, you know, people living subsistence lives, whether that be farming tiny plots of oil palm or by fishing, I think if you asked them, they would tell you that if they had the opportunity to earn more money doing something else, they would happily do that. And as far as sort of resource sustainability, I think that's more of an external issue that's being imposed on Indonesia, because everyone who can poaches in Indonesia's archipelagic waters. It's not just the massive, you know, state-owned fishing fleets of China or state-backed fishing fleets. It's Vietnam, it's Malaysia, it's, you know, it's even PNG. So they're having to sort of elbow out fishermen from all over. So if there's a sustainability issue, it's probably not the small-time fishers in Rote Island.
The email address is global.roaming@abc.net.au. Please keep your feedback coming, and we'll try and get to some more of it next week. Laura Tingle, something to recommend, please.
Well, Hamish, I'm going to recommend a book by Hamish McDonald, but the other
not,
Hamish
not
McDonald.
Not this one.
Yeah, which is an oldie but a goodie, called Democracy, with a K and an S. Came out probably 15 years ago. Absolutely superb short history of Indonesia. If mad fans of the series over the last few episodes haven't read it, go out and get yourself a copy. It's wonderful stuff.
Amanda, would you like to recommend something?
I tell you what I am reading. It's been such a tonic, and that's Julia Baird's Phosphorescence. I'm quite late to it, but when you're working a lot and travelling a lot, and it's quite stressful, and every now and again I'll read a couple of pages of her book, and I find it really, really comforting and relaxing. So, yeah, I would recommend that.
And what a beautiful writer Julia Baird is.
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks to our producers on this episode, Rebecca Metcalf, supervising producer Kylie Gray, and executive producer Laura McAuliffe. Amanda, so good of you to join us on this episode. I hope we can roam again with you soon.
Thanks, Hamish. Thanks, Laura.
Amanda Hodge there in Jakarta. Laura, see you next time.
See you next time, Hamish.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.